Hi, this is David Joe Montgomery with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Just want to give kudos to the Texas Tribune, which is my homepage and a valuable source of news. Welcome to the Tribune podcast.
Thank you, Davey Joe. This is Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the final week of February. Joining me is Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Editor Emily Ramshaw.
I love that, Davey Joe.
Do you love Jim Henson of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin?
Almost as much.
That kind of confuses the introduction, but hi, Reeve.
What's this Tribcast about?
No, we should also say we're recording this on Davy Joe's wife's birthday, so a special shout-out and happy birthday wishes to her. From me. I don't know about the rest of you.
From Reeve, yeah.
Yeah.
Were we supposed to break out into song?
I think you should just, you know, say something nice. Happy he did birthday. Do an intro for us.
Happy birthday.
Felicitaciones.
Nice. Which
is a great transition into the two lawmakers I went to visit, neither of whom speaks Spanish.
Emily just returned from a trip to D.C., and we thought we'd have her fill us in on the people that she hung out with there, one of whom hates communists, and the other one shares last name with a famous communist.
Oh, that joke.
Which one do you like to start with?
I went to D.C., for starters, to visit with Joaquin Castro for a New York Times profile that you'll be able to read this coming weekend. And then I transitioned and went across the street to visit with Ted Cruz. It was a very timely day to meet with Cruz because I met with him about 2 hours before the official Hegel vote, and we all know how he feels about Hegel.
This is Chuck Hegel.
Chuck Hegel, sorry, yes.
Yeah, he doesn't believe in the dialectic.
The new Secretary of Defense.
The new Secretary of Defense, right. And so part of the reason I was meeting with both of them is because they have both sort of been in the limelight for largely different reasons.
Well, obviously, of course, you could have read a profile of Cruz any day of the week for the past week or so.
It's true. I also could have seen Annie Leibovitz spread of the two Castro brothers in Vogue magazine.
Somehow I missed that.
I actually had reason to buy Vogue at the airport because I never do that on the company dime. It's like $6.
Wow, she expensed Vogue.
It weighed
85 pounds, right?
Yep. Anyway, but you know.
Did she put them in like a bathtub full of milk? Isn't that the famous. Who was in that photo? It's a famous Annie Leibovitz photo.
Nice.
If Evan were here, he would know. Thank goodness he isn't. Evan hasn't had his Annie Leibovitz spread yet. I'm sure it's only a matter of time. He was an Austin man.
Evan will be in a bathtub full of cell phones, I think.
Yeah, right. But anyway, you know, what's interesting about Castro is that for the last couple of years, I think it's fair to say he's sort of taken a back seat to his 1 minute older identical twin brother, you know, really helped him in his campaigns for mayor. He was the one who introduced his brother at the Democratic National Convention when Julian Castro gave the very, you know, prominent keynote address. I think what you're seeing now is, I mean, I think it's fair to say the tables are turning a little bit, and you're seeing, you know, Joaquin is like on every morning show. He's making the circuit. I think the Obama administration has really relied on him to sort of send an immigration message, comprehensive immigration reform message in Washington. He's become, he's the president of the freshman class, of his freshman class. He's becoming sort of a big name, you know, in some ways. I think he may have more national exposure than his brother will have in the coming years. Would you agree with that, Dr. Henson?
It depends how it breaks, but he certainly is. I agree. He's having kind of his time in the barrel right now, and is making the most of it. He's been good on the stuff that I've seen him in, so mm-hmm. You know, it's been impressive.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it seems like Castro is really the one that's getting most of the limelight of the new Texas.
You mean
Cruz?
Cruz. Well, thank you. Yes. I meant not Castro.
Right. I mean, I think, you know.
Which one of these is not a Castro?
Up until this last sentence he was, yeah.
Limelight is the question, you know, or, you know, notoriety. I mean, I think, you know, what you really saw with Cruz was something that his constituents have probably loved, which is he's really come out swinging. He could sort of give a damn about, you know, rules of decorum, quote unquote, rules
of
decorum.
He's the new Huey Long.
Right. I mean, so he, you know, came out swinging on Hegel. You know, there have been all these sort of cries, I think, from folks on the left of, you know, is he insinuating that Hegel has ties to foreign enemies, McCarthyism?
Well, it's not cries. He insinuated that.
He also would argue that if you listen to the full, you know, full tape, that he also, you know, lauded his Hegel's experience in the military and his service to the country, and that, you know.
But you can be a decorated veteran and still have ties to foreign enemies.
Cruz really blames the media for this whole thing. You know, the question is how much he likes the attention and the position that this
is. He's not exactly an unwitting victim of the media. He knows how this works.
Right.
He said, it is at a minimum relevant to know if that $200,000 deposit in his bank account came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. It's a pretty direct insinuation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was interested to read your interview. I mean, there's, you know, we've talked, you know, some level we've kind of talked Cruz into the ground. But, you know, in terms of looking at your interview, I thought it was interesting how much he wants to be seen as somebody delivering straight talk, but near as I could tell in the questions, at least that you included in the page, he didn't answer any of them directly. You asked him, you know, whether, you know, what he thought about the charges of McCarthyism, and he didn't really say anything about that other than that he had also said he was a, you know, as you say, a decorated war veteran, etc. You asked him about whether what he thought about Republicans criticizing him and whether that made the criticism seem more valid. His response was that the criticisms all came from Democrat and the New York Times.
Right. He
and
really
so
hates
on.
The New York Times.
I mean, so, it, well, I mean, you know, he
it's
can
a,
hate.
It's a good foil.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Does he hate the New York Times? Does he not hate the New York Times? I mean, to me, he's still trading, you know, in terms of his appeal to the base on, you know, Perry 2009, 2010. It's all about the New York Times. It's all about the liberal media, and it's all about President Obama. The reason we have are at a budget impasse is because President Obama won't negotiate it. The reason we can't solve immigration is because President Obama won't negotiate it. And to me, I don't see anything particularly dynamic about this. And I also think it's sort of right out of a very well-worn playbook to say, hey, you know, I don't have to run for re-election for another 5.5 years. Why not go to the wall right now and then tack later? Now, there's this whole thing about the norms of being a freshman and all this kind of stuff. But that's been breaking down, too.
Well, and I think he's right about that. I think you can break down those norms of being a freshman and just blow through that. You know, Rand Paul's been doing that. You know, that's an old story. I don't think that right. He necessarily is tacking away from the people who elected him. If you look at the 700 or 800,000 people who decide Republican primaries in Texas, I don't think that Cruz has done anything.
No, I'm not saying he is.
Off key for those folks at all.
No, I'm not saying he does. But what's typical for a senator, and it's actually the way the institutions are designed, is that he can do what he wants now, and he's got plenty of time to tack later.
Right. Right.
So, you know, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago who was saying, you know, it's one thing to be, you know, a maverick on these kinds of issues and to buck the system. You know, he's one Air Force base away from not doing that anymore.
but is it effective, though? I mean, he had some valid points, I think, about the, you know, his point basically with the Hegel thing was that we need to get more information from him. We need more disclosure. And, of course, the Tribune, obviously, based on, our business as usual series, I think people know we are pro-disclosure, pro-information coming to light.
Especially but, when it helps us do our but, job and write those.
You know, you can make that point and maybe stories. It gets buried, but you make that point and say, we need more disclosure so that we know if he's tied to North Korea. Of course, it gets him in the headlines. Also gets him some negative attention from the left, which, of course, his base doesn't care about. But is it an effective way to do it?
Right. Well, and can you call for more disclosure without making that leap?
Without making the insinuation. You can say, right, we want you to disclose where this money came from. That's mm-hmm. different from, we want you to prove that this money didn't come from that evil box over there, you know?
Right.
Well, and, you know, and when you say, is it effective, I mean, effective for what and for whom, right? It's effective for him.
Well,
right.
and to go back a week on Emily's, you know, playlist here, you know, John Cornyn clearly saw a ghost in all of what Ted Cruz has been doing. I mean, he's been tacking loudly to the right. Now, there's an argument that he's always been very conservative,
right,
and so
maybe
on.
Having Kay Bailey gone is letting him really embrace
well,
his full,
yeah, but
his
you
true
know,
conservative potential.
I think there's a lot to be said for the argument that, you know, he's on the ballot in 2014. It's clear that the establishment wing of the Republican Party didn't have a great 2012, and Ted Cruz is being loud, and John Cornyn is harmonious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's the broader context here is that the right side of the political spectrum in the Republican Party has opened up. There's more space over there right now. And, you know, Republican primary, if you don't fill that space, somebody else will. And, you know, whether it's how he's behaving in Senate or how the election went, Cruz is obviously exhibit A in that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Right. Emily, did you happen to run into any of the other new congressmen from Texas?
I didn't. I ran into a lot of Texas people who were there for different reasons. I think there was a Republican governor's event going on. So Perry had actually been at the White House, I think, where with all the other governors for an event.
On the lawn? Or
yeah, right. And a lot of the lobby was up there this time of year. It's a very full flight from that Southwest flight from Austin to
the Reagan Airport.
It's like full of Texas lobbyists.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the right side of Texas. Now we'll, I guess, transition to the left side. And the battleground Texas is hoping to come and turn the state blue.
They're getting an awful lot of press.
Well, they're doing sort of the mouthy part of this correctly. You know, you get a megaphone and you make a bunch of noise and you hope that people will send you a bunch of money from which you can work. You know,
right.
It's a remarkably, you know, they're going to say this over and over for the next 6 years, it's a remarkably expensive place to do what they're trying to do. And the trick is going to be, can they raise enough money to do it, and will they stay on task long enough to see whether this is actually a good idea or not? You know, they've always, you know, past efforts like this have been underfunded and unsustained. And so really one of the questions here is, if you really did this and you really did this right, what would be the effect of it? You know, what they're trying to do is organize Texas voters. You know, their first line, I guess, is register more people, try to get the people who are registered now to actually show up at the polls, which I think is actually where the numbers go crazy on them, and then try to figure out who their voters are and whether they can get their voters mobilized without mobilizing the other side at the same time.
And how realistic a proposition is turning Texas blue? Governor Perry really laughed it off at a press avail earlier this week.
Well, they're not going to flip the whole state, but they're going to flip a piece and then flip a piece. The way this has worked in other places, Colorado, New Mexico, Florida,
Ohio
to some extent, you know, the question is, you know, partly organizational and partly do you have the candidates and are they saying the right things and are the people who are currently in power doing things that make voters look up and say, hey, I'd like a choice here?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as not impossible that you could make inroads. Will they do it? Will they raise the money?
Right.
Will they put the right people in place? And how, I mean, one of the interesting subtexts to me here is how does this effort being organized by, you know, emanating essentially from the national level, it seems like.
Well, specifically from the Obama campaign.
How does that mesh with the situation on the ground here, and how does it mesh with pre-existing structures, pre-existing organizations, pre-existing interests? I mean, everybody right now is jumping up and down and saying, yep, we're all on board, sounds great, come on down, bring your bucket of money, you know, we're happy to reverse the flow. When they get down there and, you know, they show up, you know, and start talking to the consultants and they start trying to spend the money and they start making decisions about that, how all that works is a whole other question. And I still think that while party identification is a key factor here, they've still got to find candidates.
Right.
But isn't
right.
this work that, you, in theory, the Texas Democratic Party and, I mean, OFA had Organizing for America, the Obama campaign basically has been here for years now. Is this not what they should have been doing or have been doing? Like, why do we need a new organization to do this?
They looked at this thing like everybody looks at this thing. If you're looking at a national map and you say, you know, where do we get the most bang for the buck? You get the most bang for the buck in states that don't have 21 media markets and don't have, you know, these. You have to move a lot of money through Texas to get the same impact you might be able to get, you know, with a little bit of money in some other state. You can win a Senate seat in North Dakota or Wyoming a whole lot cheaper. Then you can win, you know, almost win a state Senate seat in Texas. It's just a very expensive, difficult place to work.
But massive investment for a potentially massive payoff.
Right. On the other hand, yeah, the lottery win here is, mm-hmm. if you can get it, is if, you know, somebody pointed this out the other day. If Texas were to go, this might have actually been Cruz. If Texas were to go blue, that's the end of the Republican Party. If Texas and California and New York are blue, you're done. you know, the electoral map's over.
Well, no, I don't think, you know, I mean, in answer to your question, Reeve, I mean, I also think that the story hasn't been written much. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, look at everybody being on the same team and say, you know, the Obama for America folks have been here, you know, since 2007, really. You know, how come there hasn't been spillover? But, you know, there have been instances, some of it, you know, spilling into public every once in a while, of friction between the Obama people and the local folks in terms of how the money gets spent, you know, which way the resources get shared. I mean, I know there were conflicts during the White campaign over voter lists and voter files and voter lists and this.
Right.
And, you know, that's,
I mean, I think,
those are the issues that need to be worked out and are very difficult to work out because there are, in fact, you know, competing interests here.
Well, and friction may be a nice word for it. I mean, there's been incredible frustration, I think, on the part of local Democrats that there hasn't been a more concerted national investment here. You know, just by nature of having the Obama folks here doesn't necessarily mean that will happen. And I think now you're finally sort of seeing what they hope is this big national investment in Texas, and hopefully the dollars that come along with it for their sake.
And again, I'm sure people are going to start resetting, but I mean, you know, there are, you know, reasonably, you know, documented instances of, you know, kind of pissiness over Obama coming to Texas and raising money, then taking the money with him and leaving.
Right. But well, that's the way of the world. I mean, yeah, you know, Texas is, you know, it's where the money is, and it's not where the money is best spent. And so you go raise money here, you go raise money in California, but you don't put a lot of money on the ground in those two states because they're too expensive to win.
But there seems to be, at least for the narrative, if not for the spending money, much more of an appetite for this story nationally than there is in the state. And the state people seem to be like, well, I'll believe it when I see it. Whereas, you know, Jeremy Byrd from Battleground, Texas has been on Colbert. He's been...
He's selling it.
You know, I mean, every news story in Politico.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, you might be confusing supply and demand there.
Right.
Well, I didn't really...
Well, there's not really an election story. There's not really an election story right now. There's not really a race to write about. So, you know, hey, let's talk about this process story where these guys are trying to organize a big state. You know, that's the news hole they're following in.
Christina Gomez has a big new job.
Right.
Yeah, so is she going to keep doing the When in Session blog?
I hope the When in Session Tumblr keeps going. That's the best thing so far this session.
That's a digital
Consider
strategy.
Consider that Ross's request, Christina, if you're out there.
That's right. Keep that thing going.
No, I agree. I think, in my sense, that's a good hire. I mean, that's somebody who knows Texas. It's somebody who's obviously got a knack for digital stuff.
Well, and she can tell them something about the territorial wars that they're walking into. Look out over there. Look to your left. Look to your right.
Should we say who she is?
Go ahead.
Emily.
Well, she's their...
she's the When in Session Tumblr-ess.
Yeah, but she's going to be running Battleground Texas. I think, like, it's, you know, it's social media strategy, right?
Right, she came, yeah.
Previously worked for TM at Trey Martinez-Fisher.
Right, she worked for the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. She, right. You know, I think an Austin native came from and went to school in San Marcos, right?
Right, I think that's right.
And, you know, knows Texas well.
She may just be making this stuff up.
She can write a
Nobel
Prize for Literature in 1943.
Yeah.
She got a Grammy for that album she did.
Turns out she's a big Republican, actually. She just moved here from D.C., but let's move the podcast back to D.C. and talk about what's going on there at the Supreme Court today as we record this, right?
Right. They're arguing Section 5. It's a Shelby County, Alabama case. And the basic idea here is that the states that are bound to ask for federal permission when they change their election laws under the Voting Rights Act are asking the courts to knock that down and say, you don't have to ask for permission anymore. And they've got a couple of counts here. One of them is that, you know, they say there's not any evidence at the moment of any intentional discrimination in the redistricting that we've done, so this problem is gone. And you've got this problem, they are arguing to the court, of asking some of having a federal law that applies to some states but not all states. So why is it that you can draw a map in Michigan and just fly with it that you couldn't draw in Texas or Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama? And that's
there's a federalism right. overlay to this particular argument,
right?
Which is interesting.
So, you know, Texas has joined in this in a friendly brief, and basically Texas and these other states and jurisdictions that are covered, you know, it's got weird little places, like there's a chunk of Brooklyn, but it's mostly the southern states, and they're basically trying to get out from under asking for federal permission when they change things like voter ID laws, you know, election polling place laws, redistricting maps, all of that kind of stuff.
Right. And, you know, and there's obviously a, you know, a larger kind of arc to this argument about, you know, at a fundamental level, there is, you know, there's a sense of, you know, has the Voting Rights Act done its work or not?
Right. Yeah. Are we finished here yet?
Are we finished here yet or not? And
what is its work? To end racism?
Well, I would say to end voting, the expression of voting discrimination based on race and ethnicity in the electoral system. Yeah.
And so has it worked?
You're asking me. I think the Voting Rights Act has been pretty effective.
It's re-enfranchised a lot of voters who were disenfranchised all during the 50s and 60s and, you know, up to them.
You know, and I think, empirically, Congress has seen fit, and this is one of the interesting elements of this argument, Congress has seen fit to renew this act
for the next 25 years.
Recently
under George W. Bush.
Right, and the last time under George W. Bush. And so there's an argument that many of the opponents are making here that for a court that seems to want to talk about judicial restraint,
right,
the court very well, you know, could be taken as interfering in something that is basically about something Congress should be doing. Now, you know, if you make a constitutional argument here, there's a medium. We were talking earlier about there's a medium ground. We were talking earlier about how the predictions about the Affordable Care Act going before the Supreme Court were almost uniformly wrong. I mean, you can go and think there were one or two people that, you know, predicted the outcome out of the, you know, hundreds that were trying to predict it. And I think, you know, we're seeing this sort of, do they strike it down? Do they maintain it?
Yeah, so the early questions apparently were hostile.
Yeah, but
right. Allegedly hostile. Right. That worked last time.
There's a very likely outcome that they can address this in a way that sends it back to Congress in a way that Congress is very unlikely to actually address it, and so they can kill it by sending it back to the legislature.
And the court has sort of indicated there was a case out of a municipal utility district in Austin that went all the way to the Supreme Court a few years ago, and the court signaled, I think Roberts wrote the footnote, there was a mm-hmm. signal in a footnote that, you know, you guys aren't asking us about Section 5 in this North Austin mud case, but if you did ask us about Section 5, we're ready to hear that. So that's sort of the marker that everybody's going on. Well, Roberts is willing to have a look at this thing.
Right. I mean, they've been sending signals that they want to look, or at least the conservative majority has. On the other hand, you know, going back to that Austin, to that Northwest Austin?
North Austin mud number one.
That case actually
is the name of a great, you know, dive bar.
Yep. Yeah,
the famous Namudno case, right?
You know, I mean, that case had, you know, I mean, the outcome of that case fell short of invalidating Section 5 by saying that, you know, there were, you know, that the MUD had to be able to withdraw from the agreement, which was already in the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act to begin with.
Right.
So, I mean, I think, again, the MUD case establishes a precedent that is legislatively oriented. And so this idea, you know, so this really is driven by, it seems, a desire of some members of the court to really take this on frontally. And that's where, you know, some of the question is.
So basically, if this works, then isn't that an argument to keep it around? And if it hasn't worked, then maybe it needs strengthening. No? I mean, what's the argument for getting rid of it? It's just that it's...
Well, the argument for getting rid of it is that it only applies to some states. It doesn't apply to others, that it's an unnecessary, that it's no longer a necessary federal oversight of what should be a state function and what was originally a state function.
Right.
And
So there's two interrelated arguments. It's that it's worked, it's done, we don't need it anymore.
Mission accomplished.
Right. But the backup is that the mechanisms of the mission were flawed to begin with in many cases.
Right. The argument to keep it, you know, there are a bunch of arguments to keep it. One of which was in this most recent Texas redistricting case in which a DC circuit court said, we're not going to give you Section 5 clearance on your plans because these plans, we've got evidence of intentional discrimination in the 2011 legislative session in Texas on these maps. So one of the arguments, you know, that doesn't present in the Shelby County case, but that does present in the larger argument is that, you know, the idea that this has already worked and that the mission is accomplished is actually false.
Well, that's the argument Trey Martinez Fisher makes in the pages of Politico today, digital pages.
And of the Texas Tribune.
The screens
yesterday.
Of Politico. And the screens of the Tribune.
It's true.
Right. So there.
Yeah. Hot tip, Julian Aguilar.
Yeah. Well, what else has been going on in the Tribune? You had a Trib Live this morning. This morning is Wednesday morning.
I had a healthcare Trib Live this morning with two doctors and members of the legislature, John Zerwas and Charles Schwartner. having a little problem getting that last name out this morning. Schwartner.
And you're still sick.
And I'm still sick. I know. I was up there with an orthopedic surgeon and an anesthesiologist, and luckily neither
of them. Not great for respiratory right. stuff.
I'm right. a little tired and my back feels better, but I still got a cold.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, the primary subject of conversation was the Medicaid expansion and what Texas is going to do in the wake of all these other states with Republican governors, you know, starting to say they are going to play ball and expand Medicaid.
Most recently, Chris Christie.
Most recently, Chris Christie, but probably more important than Chris Christie was Rick Scott in mm-hmm. Florida, you know, a southern state, a governor who's been an ally to Perry. I think that was, and a ton of uninsured people. So that was, I think, probably.
And a governor who was a former hospital executive.
Exactly. Right? So a big shot in the arm for the Obama administration. Perry has continued to say, you know, we are not going to expand Medicaid here in Texas. I think the message from lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, is that's right, we're not going to expand Medicaid in Texas unless the Obama administration gives us the flexibility, the buzzword, that we desire to do it the way that we want to.
So is this, in your view, a standoff or is this a negotiation?
I mean, I believe it's more of a negotiation than a standoff. I think politically, the way they're presenting it is a standoff. I think behind the scenes, it's definitely a negotiation.
Couldn't a standoff just be a negotiating tactic?
Well, that's what I'm asking. I mean, is Texas really drawing a line here and saying,
yes,
we're not going to do this ever, ever, ever? Or are they just drawing a line from which they'll negotiate?
I mean, I think it's more of the latter.
More the latter, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So do we end up with this federal money coming into Texas or not?
I think not the first year. I think not. I don't think we're going to get this figured out in 2013. But I think in the next couple of years, we're going to find some kind of middle ground where Texas gets what it wants and the Obama administration gets what it wants.
And is there any political repercussion if Texas leaves all those people uninsured? Or, on the other hand, if Texas takes this money and jumps into, you know, what a lot of Republicans view as a terrible federal program?
There has so far been no political repercussion for leaving a large portion of our population uninsured. I don't see that changing under the current, you know, governing structure. You know, I think, will there be repercussions if Perry switches his tune? First of all, he's not going to switch his tune. He's really, really stubborn. Second of all, any tune switching would not be defined as tune switching. It would be, you know, the Obama administration.
That wasn't a tune in the first place.
The Obama administration has given us, you know, Texas. It's a win for Texas, the flexibility that Texas demanded.
They finally started singing the harmony part to the song we've been singing all along.
Only their complete collapse to our demands allowed this to go forward.
Right, exactly.
That's exactly how I got all three of you on this Tripcast.
Well, you know, you're going to have to burn those envelopes.
It's a really inside baseball argument. I mean, it's about political position. I mean, you know, the public, I think, knows very little about this. So it's not like people are looking at public opinion, maybe a little bit among Republican primary voters. But, you know, for the most part, I it's hard for me to imagine that eventually they're not going to take the money. In some shape, matter, or form, they're not going to get it as a block grant. The Obama administration is not going to give Rick Perry a block grant, period. It's not going to happen.
But they probably, you know, I mean, they have given some of these other states some, you know,
sure,
at least facial. I don't know if they're how significant they'll turn out to be, but facially, they've given them some waivers.
Well, they've given Texas a waiver.
Right.
I mean, this is not unheard of. You know, it's not the sexiest thing to talk about, but this 1115 waiver that the Obama administration gave Texas is allowing Texas to do some creative things. So we'll just see if they'll do it again.
I was going to make a joke about sexy 1115 waivers, but I just passed on it.
Our listeners are going to be so disappointed.
It was going to be a great joke, though.
Save it for next time.
I went to this dinner honoring Joe Strauss at the Annette Strauss Institute with Strauss, Perry, Dewhurst, and Bill Powers and Brian McCall, and they had some similar jokes along those lines.
So while you were doing that, just a quick sidebar, while you were doing that, I was watching George P. Bush introduced Jeb Bush at the Texas Business Leadership Council just to go see if this new kid could talk in front of a crowd. And he can talk in front of a crowd. He's actually better than his uncle was 20 years ago when George W. Bush was first starting off. So,
And I went to that dinner to see if the people I just listed could all get along, and they can in public.
So now we know.
Yeah.
What did he talk about?
You know, George P. talked. I mean, he just did a quick vignette. This group was interested in school choice and those issues, and he did a quick vignette on teaching in an inner city school system and starting with 150 kids and getting 110 110 or 120 through the program, and you know what was entailed in that and how difficult it is to get people through a public school system that's not competitive with something else, kind of laid the groundwork for the speech his father made about school choice in Florida.
I assume it was better when he told it.
Absolutely.
A little
absolutely.
More dynamic.
But I won't be appearing on a ballot near you, so.
All right. Well, if you'd like to vote for Ross anyway or send any questions or comments, you can send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. In the meantime, on behalf of Jim, Emily, Ross, our producer Todd, this is Reeve. And I should say also that there are some significant changes coming to the Tribcast next week, including new sponsors and possibly a new theme song.
So and a new host.
Stay tuned.
Just kidding.
Thanks for listening.
Does that sound good? I'm here. I appreciate it. That was fun.